Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Kawaski.
Have you lied recently? Well, I admit it, I have, but only because the internet made me do it. This is Jane Karwoski, Dr. J, along with my co-host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico. I am an experimental psychologist who likes to ponder how the norms you and I live by are being impacted by social networking and media. Now, you tell me, how many times have you signed up for some kind of online service by checking that little box that says, I have read and agree to the terms of use? But you didn't really read all those terms and conditions, because if you did and are an average user of services, you would spend the entire month of your working year reading those contracts. Our guest today is Nancy S. Kim, a professor of law at California Western School of Law and a visiting professor at the Rady School of Management at UC San Diego. And get this, she's the chair of the contract section of the Association of American Law Schools and a past member of the executive committee of the Internet and Computer Law section. So she is well aware of these situations, and Professor Kim is the author of WRAP Contracts, Foundations and Ramifications, which focuses on how contracts, including the terms of use, affect and control online behavior. Professor Kim, a warm and hearty welcome to the Social Network Show.
Thank you. It's my great pleasure to be here again, and I'm excited to talk about something that makes a lot of people's eyes roll back in their head and fall asleep, which is contracts. But as you mentioned, it's something that affects all of us, everyone who goes online every day.
Well, what is a WRAP contract?
A WRAP contract is a term that refers to a non-traditional, non-negotiated contract. So basically, it's a contract presented in a take-it-or-leave-it manner in a format that wasn't generally used before, let's say, 1970.
Okay.
It's a contract that you don't sign with a pen.
Mm-hmm.
And your listeners will be most familiar with click wraps or tap wraps, depending on whether they've encountered the agreement on their while at their computer and they clicked on it with their mouse, or whether they encountered it on their smartphone and they tapped on it with their finger. In that case, they've likely clicked agree. There are also browse wraps, which are hyperlinks on a web page. And they're usually at the bottom of a website, and they typically say something like terms or terms of use or legal notice or something
mm-hmm.
like that. And there's also something now called a modified click wrap. That's what some courts have called it. And I refer to them as multi-wraps. And that's where you have an accept button. So you have sort of the click component of a click wrap and a hyperlink. So it's sort of a combo click wrap, a browse wrap.
Mm-hmm. Well, seriously, does anybody read those terms?
No. Studies have shown, and we know this, right? Studies have shown that almost nobody, and I really hate to say almost, because that's just the lawyer in me saying almost. The fact is that nobody reads all of the contracts that they agree to all the time. Online.
Jim, have you ever read them?
Well, I tried.
Everyone tries. I mean, not every, you know, people will say they tried because you know you're supposed to read your contracts, but
mm-hmm.
nobody actually reads them.
But, you know, can you really call them contracts, because most people don't read them? I thought a contract was something that was written on sheets of paper that two people negotiated and with lawyers usually involved.
Right. Now, as strange as this might be for non-lawyers, and even for many lawyers to understand, these WRAP contracts are considered contracts under the law.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because there's been a lot of research in this area that shows that very few people read the terms before they click agree.
Mm-hmm.
But the courts really aren't interested in that. What they want to know, they're not interested in whether users have actually read the terms or whether or not the terms are in fact readable. They just want to know whether users had notice of the terms and whether there was some way to indicate that they were accepting or rejecting those terms.
Oh, okay. So it's like you've been served, whether you read it or not.
Well, yes, but what's even trickier here and more puzzling for non-lawyers, and again, even some lawyers, is that in some cases, the only way to reject terms is by not clicking, which means, you know, if you don't click, you're not allowed to continue on a website. And because mm-hmm. all websites have these, you can't really use any, you can't go online then. But in some cases, you're deemed to have accepted just by doing what you were already doing. So you have notice, and the idea is you understood there was a contract involved, and you didn't immediately leave the website. And in some cases, that will be deemed acceptance.
Well, why do you think most people don't read the terms?
There's a lot of academic research in this area, and most of it tells us what we already know, which is that people don't read the terms because there are too many of them. Okay, they don't think there is any point in reading them because the terms are non-negotiable. And if you think about it, how is anyone going to do this? There's been some research done, and I get the figure. I don't have the number the figure in my head right now, but it's something like you would spend a month of your life or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's a huge amount of time if you try to read every contract that was thrust your way, because it's not just the contract you encounter. There are hyperlinks in the web pages, and those are deemed incorporated by reference. Not only that, a lot of online agreements have what are known as modification at will clauses. Oh. I refer to these as the now you see them, now you don't clauses, because the company in these clauses reserves the right to change their terms at any time. So it's no longer enough for you to devote a month of your time reading the contracts that you're faced with on a particular website, but you have to keep reading them. You have to keep checking to make sure that the company has not modified their terms. So it's incredibly inefficient for the consumer to read their online contracts.
Mm-hmm. Well, this seems like it puts the consumer in a bit of a bind here. That sounds ridiculous. Are the modifications at will clauses, especially those, are they really enforceable?
Well, the courts are split in this area. Some courts have actually said, yes, they are enforceable. Others have said no, but in those cases, the reason the courts have said no had more to do with the way the changes were the way that the consumer got notice of the changes.
Hmm.
What the courts haven't done is they haven't considered the aggregate nature of all the contracts that the consumer is bombarded with every time they go online. I mean, the consumer really faces a rather coercive online contracting environment.
Exactly. I mean, if you don't sign, you don't get the service.
But it's not just that you don't get that service. You pretty much can't use the internet. You can't get on the internet.
Because everyone.
You can't use any service. Because now, online, all websites have terms of use. All websites have user agreements. All websites have hyperlinks in those agreements. So it's really, you really can't do anything but surrender.
Well, is it hopeless then? I mean, for the consumer?
Well, I hate to say that it's hopeless, because there are things that the consumer can do, and to protect themselves. And the primary thing they can do is be informed, because you can't express your outrage if you don't know that you should be outraged by something.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these terms are pretty outrageous. The problem is there are a number of cognitive biases at work here. There's the optimism bias, where even if there is a lousy term in a contract, you don't think that term will be enforced against you, for example. Okay. We also tend to be like sheep, in a sense.
Yeah.
And that we think that if nobody's complaining about it, it must not be as bad as we think. I mean, somebody's got to be looking out for our own interests, right? So that, there are a number of things going on here that make consumers less willing to act. But as far as what they should do, they should stay informed. And one way to do that is there is an organization called faircontracts.org. And they're part of Ralph Nader's Citizens Work. And full disclosure, I'm on the board. And what they do is they work to make contract terms more fair for consumers, and they organize around certain issues. And when consumers organize, there's evidence that companies will react. So what users can do is they can complain about contract terms when they hear about them. They, again, they have to stay informed in order to do anything. And then if they post on Facebook, things can go viral.
Okay? Uh-huh.
They can blog, they can tweet, they can post on Facebook. And if they organize and use their social networks to complain about unfair contract terms, companies will listen. There's evidence that companies will listen. So, for example, General Mills recently.
I'd like to go into that in detail, and let's bridge over to that in the next segment, and we'll talk about exactly what kind of harm these wrap contracts can do, as well as what we can do about it.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
This moment of uncontrollable laughter was made possible by a 32-year-old man with little to no coordination attempting to execute a simple cartwheel. His name is Sergeant Warner, but young James, our laughing friend here, simply calls him Dad. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, and Jim and I are talking with Nancy Kim, professor of the California Western School of Law and author of Wrap Contracts, Foundations and Ramifications. We were getting into, you had mentioned General Mills and how they responded to consumer pushback on something with regard to terms of use. What did that involve?
Well, General Mills recently had to backtrack on changes to their online agreement, which if you visited their website, it's gone now, but if you had visited it a couple weeks ago, mm-hmm. there was a little notice at the top of the page that said, we've changed our terms of use. I forget the exact language, but it basically said that anyone who uses this website, if there's a problem with any between the company and the user, that the user will have to go to arbitration. So it basically took away the consumer's right to sue General Mills in the event that there was a dispute between the company and the consumer. And somehow, this news reached the media, and consumer groups spread the word, and it started to just sort of take off. People were complaining about it on Facebook posts, and they were tweeting about it. And a few days later, General Mills backtracked, and they said, "We're taking this back. We're not going to require this anymore."
I read some of the responses the response they posted, and it was very apologetic. And oh my goodness, we trust our customers and blah.
Right. So exactly.
That is what crisis communication is all about.
Right. The same thing happened with Instagram a couple of years ago. After Facebook acquired them, they had made some changes to their terms of use having to do with what they could do with user data, with the content that their users posted. And when, because now they're acquired by Facebook, they were no longer this little company that nobody paid attention to. When consumer groups got a hold of that, they spread the word again, and consumers and users reacted and threatened to leave Instagram, and Instagram said, "Oh, sorry, we're not going to do that anymore."
No, okay.
But you're really going to stay on these companies, though, because Instagram might have backtracked, but Facebook keeps doing a little bit of this. We'll try. We'll put ourselves out there. We'll get some, we'll get hit, slapped back. It's sort of like two steps forward, one step back. But they they make incremental progress for them, not progress for the consumer, in terms of using consumer content.
Well, now, this forced arbitration clause, what happens, what are the disadvantages to arbitration and giving up the right to sue?
Well, this was unusual. A lot of companies have a mandatory or forced arbitration clauses. This was very unusual for General Mills to have, because General Mills sells products that consumers eat. So usually you think, well, if I, let's say, my child ingests bad, cereal because there's some foreign substance in it, this basically says that I can't sue them in court. The problem with arbitration is that it may, in some cases, cost hundreds of dollars just to file an arbitration claim. Arbitration decisions might typically are final, and often there's no record. So the decisions are in a black box, so to speak. There's no precedential sort of history as far as the way a particular arbitrator decided, what their reputation is like. You don't have any of that information. So it's really hard to say why this negatively affects consumers so much, because we don't have any information about this. There's anecdotal evidence, and there's lots of speculation that most arbitration decisions will favor the company, because the company is the repeat player. They're the ones that the arbitrator will get business from, not the one-time consumer.
So, Nancy, if I understand you correctly, then, in arbitration, especially binding arbitration, case law and precedent is not a active factor. Is that true?
Well, you won't be able to refer to or find past arbitration decisions.
Wow. Okay.
As far as what the arbitrator considers, well, you would hope they would consider the law in the area, but again, we don't have any information.
So it's really kind of like the company's just saying, we're going to protect ourselves against suits, and they just make that rule. But another thing...
They don't want the bad publicity.
Yeah, right. And the privacy, so often you see, we value your privacy, and here are our privacy policies. And I have taken time to read some of a few, and... you find out they don't value your privacy at all. So what is, in the so-called privacy policy, what does that permit companies to do?
Well, what's interesting about privacy policies is, as you noted, they don't actually protect the company's, the user's privacy. What they do is they give you notice, again, that word, notice, supposedly give you notice, even though you're probably one of the few who actually reads the constantly changing privacy policies. And what they do is they permit companies to track you and use your personal information for all sorts of reasons that are disclosed in the privacy policy that nobody reads. And the reason that they have these so-called privacy policies is they're required by law. So they disclose them, even though they disclose them in a way that pretty much guarantees nobody's going to read them. So what they do is they're basically protecting themselves, so they can't get in trouble for using, let's say, your image in advertising or your information for advertising because you consented to it when you clicked agree, and part of what you agreed to were the terms of use and their and the terms of use incorporated by reference their privacy policy. It's this chain of things that the user is required to follow just in order to find out what they've given up the rights to.
So, Nancy, from a layman's point of view, so say just a regular person, even a business person, is out there listening to the show, and from their point of view, with your knowledge and experience, could you answer perhaps the question of, well, so what would you do? I mean, you have all this knowledge about this information and whether you read it or you don't. So what is your rule of thumb about the policy? Are you concerned about any of these agreements? What do you do when you see them? You know what I mean? Just so maybe we can help the regular person know whether to be worried or not worried.
I'm curious about that, too. What do you do?
Yeah.
Well, this answer probably won't satisfy because what I do is, because I've actually read the policies and I've actually read the terms of use, and I know the case law in this area, I'm not on Facebook.
Okay.
I don't have a Twitter account.
Okay.
I have a LinkedIn account, and
okay.
The reason is they actually just recently changed their policies, but it got to be, you know, I felt like, okay, I'm going to only use it for certain purposes. I don't link in with anyone in my personal life. I only link in with people who I know on a professional basis because I don't want that overlap. I understand it's all being collected and put in a huge database, and I've understood this for a while, and I think a lot of people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would post pictures, they would say things that they don't I think until recently, and even now, I think a lot of people don't really understand how the data can be aggregated, even though it's all disclosed in that privacy policy. But it's actually not disclosed very well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing is that in terms of what companies can do, what they are able to get away with, let's put it that way, it sounds like it has a lot to do with the courts. And what changes that? What can influence the way courts are interpreting things to where we're not protecting the consumer?
Well, that's where I think consumers, well, there are a couple of things. The problem with the courts has been, there's been this in contract law, there's this emphasis on the free market and the free will of the parties entering into contracts. That's sort of the basis of contract law, which made sense and does make sense when you're talking about two people negotiating a contract, sort of the situation that we talked about earlier on, you know, two people negotiating with lawyers involved, and then mm-hmm. you sign on a piece of paper. But that's not the world that we live in now, and that's not the world online at all. That's not the contracting environment for the consumer at all. And courts do need to recognize the reality of online contracting. And as far as what we can do is, well, first of all, I think that academics do actually have a role in this, and you know, we have to continue to, first of all, be informed about the cases. I mean, I'm actually sometimes surprised at how my colleagues may not be aware how different the online contracting cases are from the traditional contract cases, as far as what constitutes notice and what constitutes reasonable behavior. The other thing is that maybe we might have to work with legislators,
okay,
state legislators, or you know, our congressperson, senators. Also, we might work with the regulatory agencies. In particular, the Federal Trade Commission has been focused on this issue. They've actually been, you know, pretty good. But again, they're one agency; their resources are limited.
Right.
They get it. They understand that online, the way you present terms matters. And you can't just say there's notice if you're trying to find it, if you're a judge after the fact looking for a hyperlink. They understand that's not the way consumers are going to encounter this so-called contract.
Well, I think it's very valuable to know about the website you mentioned. Was it Fair
Contracts?
faircontracts.org. And we look forward to talking with you again, Professor Kim, and we appreciate your insights. This is something that's very important to all of us, so I hope that we'll continue our discussion on another show. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. Coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.